watching the ships roll in, and then I watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And she is one of the three recipients of the 2010 Awards for Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her latest book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And you have spent a lot of time with these small Pacific Island nations that are being swamped by the rising ocean due to global warming. And given what just happened on the northeast coast with New Jersey and New York taking this huge hit from the superstorm Sandy, it's beginning to look like New York is also Tuvalu.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some places all around the world, including in the U.S., that are going to have to undergo some form of very difficult urban triage where a decision is just made, look, this isn't going to work. We continue to put people in harm's way, critical infrastructure in harm's way. I'm not sure the entire island of Manhattan would need to be abandoned unless you get into the kind of some of the more extreme scenarios. But certainly the southern part of the island, which is largely reclaimed and very low-lying, and a lot of the entries into the bridges and the tunnels and the subway systems will all have to be seriously rethought. And hopefully that'll be done through changes to, you know, insurance and zoning regulations, things that just make it financially not viable to be in those places in the first place.
So are we talking about New York being like New Orleans? Because New Orleans, the Army Corps of Engineers have spent billions there, and they just had another hurricane, and some of the levees were breached. So
yeah, they're different geophysical environments. So New Orleans is in a delta, and it's rapidly subsiding, and it's in a hurricane, strong hurricane pathway. New York is, the actual island of New York is a little bit more solid, and it's not a delta region. But once the water gets high enough and it overtops, as we can see, it gets right into the massive underground infrastructure of the city, including the subway systems, the electrical lines, that sort of thing. So they're, for different reasons, we're kind of coming to the same result, which is that we really need to rethink where we're incentivizing people to live and work.
Well, you would think, though, that the people in New York, and particularly on Wall Street, the titans who, you know, the economy has become more and more financialized, and these are the people, not just those that dominate the American economy, but they're the masters of the universe in terms of the global economy, and they want to live in New York, and they just got their toes wet from the water in the Battery right next door to Wall Street. And the current issue of Business Week has front page cover story is, it's global warming, stupid. So what's your sense of whether the 1% will want to weigh in and make global warming real and, I guess, in the process, build dikes around Wall Street?
I think there's a real incredible ability of the human mind to rationalize. You'll start very soon, you'll start to see people saying, you know, this is a one-off event, forgetting that Irene gave a little taste of what was going to happen last year, and we're likely to see more events going forward. The very top of the food chain is going to say to themselves that they can buy their way out of this problem. The thing is that they're, you know, they're at the top of a pyramid, and as the entire pyramid gets undermined and corroded, all of the other financial sectors that are supporting them at the top start to become increasingly unstable, not just in the U.S. but globally. They will definitely be affected. There's no two ways around it. Building dikes around or seawalls around Manhattan is quite complicated given the geography of the area. It's not totally out of the realm of possibility, but it would take major multi-billion-dollar federal-level investment in that project at a time when the government is already quite broke. And, of course, one of the minor reasons that they're broke is the National Flood Insurance Program, which has insured all of these locations that are completely unviable over the long run. The government is telling you it's okay to live in these areas when it's really not okay to live in these areas. And a change in programs like those might actually be a real motivator for a change in behavior of those at the top, because the cost of living in those areas would go up tremendously.
Now, you're in London, and in the Thames, there are these floodgates that are supposed to stop a tidal surge, as what happened in New York with, I think, 14 foot, I think it eventually came, the surge, you know, swamping so much of New York and New Jersey. So how realistic would it be to put floodgates in the Hudson?
Well, it's possible, but I'm not sure whether that would be a complete defense or not, because the sort of events that we're seeing are multi-combination. They're very complex events. So it's not just river flooding or just storm surge. As we saw, we had, you know, a very strong storm coming in from the ocean at the same time as we had a cold front coming down, and we had full moon and myriad factors coming into play at the same time. So it would be, you know, fine to put up something on the Hudson, but if you're not also protecting from the seaside, then it's a rather incomplete defense. What's needed is a rounded analysis of vulnerabilities and a comprehensive solution offered. And if there is no comprehensive solution, a facing up to that reality and a decision about what to do next.
So turning to your book, Claire Pascal, Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And as I mentioned, you spent a lot of time on the Pacific Islands, nations that are being threatened with extinction by the rising oceans from global warming. There's a lot of jockeying going on in the Arctic as a result of the unprecedented melting of the Arctic ice caps, and Russia and Canada and other countries are getting into the act in terms of claiming territory for navigation rights as well as mineral rights. What is your sense of how much the rest of the world seems to have accepted the reality of global warming and are in fact hedging and preparing for it, while the United States, we have one political party, the Republican Party, its official policy, if you will, is to deny global warming. And, you know, the public may well be ahead of them. And neither president really talked anything about it in these debates. So the impression I get is that the rest of the world is trying to adapt or even exploit global warming, and we're just having nonsensical, anti-scientific debates here in the United States.
I think you're absolutely right. It's an unnecessarily tragic situation. China, for example, did its Arctic projections and realized this is opening up as a very important area, not just in terms of shipping routes and resources, as you mentioned, but also geostrategically in terms of getting in, you know, listening devices and various other sorts of dual-use potential equipment. So in China is now a proto-Arctic power. It has one icebreaker and others on the way. It's moving for observer status at the Arctic Council. It's heavily courting individual Arctic nations. There's talk of shipping in around 2,000 Chinese workers to set up an aluminum plant in Greenland, which would have a huge social effect in Greenland. There's a projected 2 to 3 million Chinese working in Siberia, gaining Arctic experience there. There's all over in many different aspects of economics and politics. You can see China acknowledging that these changes are happening and positioning itself to take advantage of them in a very calculated, intelligent but cool-headed way. While we're still kind of bickering over, you know, whether this was a one-off event or not, which as we know, it wasn't, because we had Irene last year, and this is going to be happening increasingly in the future.
So given that these other nations like China, Russia, and Canada are hedging and prepared to exploit geostrategic changes as a result of global warming, and the U.S. is lagging there, that's sort of depressing in a way, because this is basically accepting the inevitable rather than focusing on what we can do to prevent what may be exploitable but is a catastrophe.
Yes, I agree. I mean, and I would much prefer for us all to be saying, okay, look, this is happening, and we need to start looking for solutions of myriad sorts, you know, not just one, not just, you know, like, see if we can get more oil out of the Arctic. By the way, it's worth noticing or remarking on the disconnect within the political parties in the U.S. on this denial of climate change, because, for example, the Republicans may say there's no global warming, but then they will also say, and we're going to go into the opening Arctic and get more energy resources. Well, if the Arctic wasn't opening, how could you go and get more energy resources? What do you think is causing the opening of the Arctic in the first place? So there's sort of a pick-and-choose approach to looking at the issue that is very, very detrimental towards not even long-term, not even medium-term, but short-term positioning and survival in a dramatically changing geopolitical and geoeconomic environment.
Well, maybe God has heard the drill, baby, drill mantra.
That's right. So God is kind of hovering over the Arctic with a blow dryer, just sort of affecting that one region alone.
Right. Yeah. So just to touch on, as you have, on American domestic politics in the last few days of this election, Mitt Romney has made a big pitch for North American energy independence, and a lot of that depends upon exploiting the Canadian tar sands and building the pipelines, the Keystone pipelines. You're a Canadian. So how do you feel about the idea of us all joining together in exploiting some of the most carbon-intensive energy sources? And, of course, Mitt Romney's tied in with big coal. So if he's elected, we're going to go the opposite direction of doing anything about global warming. We will be pumping CO2 over time.
Yeah, I think that there is a real fallacy in the Keystone discussion. I can't see U.S. oil companies. I mean, it's acknowledged that U.S. oil companies are a relatively influential lobby, but U.S. oil companies don't just operate in the U.S. They operate elsewhere as well, and so I'm not so sure they're going to want to see their revenues drop in terms of imports from oil from Nigeria or Iraq or wherever into the U.S. So there's a very strong lobby within that group that does not want the U.S. to be energy independent, which is why when the discussions around Keystone were going on, nobody would actually say this oil will stay in North America. It was heading down to the south, down to the ports, and could just as likely have been put on ships and sold to the highest bidder elsewhere. So if we're saying energy independence, what you're saying is state control over the energy sector, which is antipathy, you know, it's completely against what the Republican Party says it wants to do in terms of its relationship with free enterprise. So unless the Republican Party has suddenly changed and is going towards state control over major sectors through regulations, then I don't understand their logic around energy self-sufficiency.
And Canada, of course, with its conservative leader now, are fully invested in Keystone, but they're also thinking about putting a pipeline through the First Nations territory across to the coast north of Vancouver to export the tar sands oils to China, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And I have to say that, you know, this is controversial within Aboriginal communities in Canada. Some are very keen to start doing business with China. Some see it as a way of development for their communities. Others have some very serious concerns. And China knows that, and a few years ago brought over a couple dozen Canadian Aboriginal leaders to China to basically say, we want to be your friends. And they came back, the Canadian Aboriginal leaders came back quite entranced with what was on offer to them from China. So it's a very complicated situation in terms of where allegiances are, because, you know, Canadian Aboriginal leaders have quite rightly some serious concerns about their relationship with the federal government of Canada and would like to have more independence of action. But at the same time, other groups are very aware of what this could do to their communities environmentally. So it's a real mess, very complicated mess, and it's not happening in isolation. It's happening within the context of larger geoeconomic and geopolitical shifts that are seeing echoes all over the world. What's happening with Aboriginal communities and China and Canada is also happening in the South Pacific and also happening, as I mentioned, in Greenland.
So just back to the effects of global warming impacting the Northeast and New York and New Jersey following this latest storm, and with the Business Week's cover carrying the logo, "It's Global Warming, Stupid." And we keep talking about all of the hideous things that are going to happen to the planet and its people, some of it unimaginable in terms of chaos and dislocation and death. And once the Earth is flooded, it's not going to come back. So what do you think is going to reverse this trajectory of, you know, we're talking about exploiting the geopolitical and geostrategic changes to the Earth, but we're not, you know, the focus should be, of course, as we mentioned earlier, on stopping this catastrophe from happening. What do you think it's going to take if indeed we are going to wake up?
Well, the mindset that's producing this sort of approach towards environmental change in the West is very similar to the mindset that produced the financial crisis and that is having a difficulty dealing with a rising China. Our political debate and economic debate has, in the West, has increasingly become about short-term profit and looking at the world in terms of resources. You know, and those resources specifically in terms of commodities. Everything's a commodity. Other parts of the world look at things like food, for example, not as a commodity but as a strategic asset. So Russia doesn't look at a bushel of wheat and think, okay, that's worth, you know, whatever amount on the international market. They look at that bushel of wheat and see that's domestic security for the population, which means less likely chance of political uprising. So as long as we look at the world in a short-term perspective and from a commodities perspective, we are going to make short-term decisions based on very narrow economic considerations. The rest of the world, many parts of the rest of the world, are already making the shift towards a longer-term view that looks at things as at least strategic assets. So that creates an entirely different dynamic when they're making decisions around how to interact with their environment. A very small example is China's one-child policy. I do not condone it. I think it's horrific. I'm just using it as an indication of the mindset. They made a decision about 30 years ago to limit most Chinese couples to one child. That was a resource-based decision. They took a look at their resources and they said, we don't have enough resources to feed a growing population. We will reduce our population. Now, if they reduced demand domestically so brutally, you can be sure they're going out to secure supply just as aggressively. We have not taken any sort of long-term assessment that approaches that level of kind of understanding of the finite capacity of the planet in multiple sectors. I'm not condoning a one-child solution. I'm just saying that it's an indication of how some countries are reacting very differently than we are. And ideally, we would come up with a much more humane solution that doesn't involve, you know, forced sterilizations, for example. But that is in compliance with the realities of what the planet has to offer.
Well, Claire Pascal, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical, security, and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. And her latest book is Global Warming: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.